Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We should have some fun and learn a lot this hour of the program. The authors of Dog Whistles, Walk Backs, and Washington Handshakes. Do you know what a Washington Handshake is? You will find out this hour. Decoding the jargon, slang, and bluster of American political speech. Our guests this hour are Chuck McCutcheon and David Mark. Chuck is co-author of National Journal's Almanac of American Politics and co-editor of Congressional Quarterly's Politics in America 2010. And David is editor-in-chief of Politics and a former senior editor at Politico. He is co-author of Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. They look at all kinds of things in this book. There's some really, and you can't talk about all the jargon without looking at some history, too, where certain phrase came from and what stayed with us for a long period of time. They talk about political phrases for campaign 2014. We're already hearing these a lot. Going bold, optics. The only poll that matters is the one on election day, the standard spin move of the candidate who trails in the polls, our guests say. They divide the book into various parts, starting with personality types, looking at the attack dog, the bedwetter, the backbencher, the body man, the blue dog, the boss, the bridge builder. And then they go into a lot of different terms, which have been so much a part of political jargon. It probably would behoove a lot of politicians to read this as well, because they start the book with this foreword by Jeff Greenfield, which I have to pass along to you because you can use it later on. It is really funny, an indication of why politicians need to use regular everyday speech when they're talking to people. The foreword begins with Jeff Greenfield's remembrance of and Joe Klein was an eyewitness. So in his first quickly aborted run for the presidency in 1980, Senator Bob Dole, already a 20-year veteran of Congress, was asked by a young girl in New Hampshire what he would do about acid rain. And without a second's pause, Dole replied, this cracks me up, the bills in markup, of course, to a 10-year-old girl. Oh, my gosh. I guess people get kind of out of touch. Not that he isn't a great man. We've had him on the show several times, charming as can be. But I guess you get caught up in whatever it is this Washington thing is. So we're going to have some fun this hour. Join us as you ask questions about certain kinds of political phrases, or if you want to add to their list, or if you don't know what in the heck a certain jargon means. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Hi, Chuck. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. David, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I just love that story that you started the book with. Isn't that funny? I mean, isn't that funny? It's in markup.
There's a long history of this. About 20 years after that, Al Gore got into some trouble in one of his 2000 debates with George W. Bush when he referred to something called Tozan Dingle, which was actually an internet deregulation bill that would have affected most people online. But the way he phrased it, it was a very insiderish bill that only the most ardent political junkies would have known about.
Oh, that is funny. I know one of the things that we're hearing over and over, and we're hearing it a lot in Wisconsin because our governor uses this phrase frequently, but evidently it's being used by a lot of people. One of the phrases we're hearing for campaign 2014, tell me, Chuck, how widely it's being used, is going bold. This is a bold idea. I've heard that word so much the last few years.
Yeah, in fact, we quote Scott Walker in our book as talking about using that phrase a lot. And I think we mentioned that some blogger says, you know, sometimes bold is just a clothes detergent. But yeah, I mean, it's punchy and it's evocative.
Yeah.
And it's a way to sort of sound like, you know, hey, I'm fresh and I've got something new to offer. I mean, we note that everyone from Ralph Nader to Newt Gingrich has, you know, given speeches or written books or delivered policy positions, you know, that are all about going bold.
Mm-hmm. Well, as long as you brought up Newt Gingrich, I understand, according to your book, that he was the master of the Washington handshake.
That's right. The Washington handshake being the sort where you're shaking somebody's hand and looking over their shoulder to see if there's somebody more important in the room. And any of it, but and it's probably not just unique to Washington. It might be called Hollywood Handshake or on Wall Street or elsewhere. But in Washington, it's a particularly potent way, or rather insulting mannerism. Most members of Congress are usually pretty good at avoiding this. They look you in the eye and make you feel like you're important and that they care about you. Then they move on 20 seconds later and do the same thing to somebody else. But Newt in his prime didn't even make the pretense of making people think he cared about them.
And the opposite of that would be, as you mentioned, Bill Clinton, who really was able to take you as though you were the only person in the room.
That's right. Of course, that's what got him to
right.
the White House, among other reasons. He was so good at that retail one-on-one politics, and you compare that even to his wife, the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and potential candidate in 2016. And for whatever her other merits, that's not really her strong point, kind of that one-on-one retail politics.
Yeah. I've told this story before, so bear with me if you've heard it before, but probably the two of you haven't. I interviewed Bill Clinton some years ago, and the night before the interview, I don't know how they got my phone number, but they called me at home, his advance person, and he said to me, President Clinton would like to know a little bit about you, about your background. I thought, oh my gosh, are you serious? Nobody in all my many years in radio has ever done anything like that. Isn't that something?
That really is amazing. And that I think that's sincere on his part. And then he just, that was his reputation as president, scoops up information and just wants to know more. And sometimes that was even to his detriment as president, and that he would overanalyze things, and maybe it wasn't the best use of his time. Not to say your background is not important.
But, right? Yeah, in the scheme of things, it really isn't. That's for
well,
sure.
I would say think about Chuck or I background as well.
Right. You write early on that it takes roughly a year of working in D.C., which you both do, to get in the know, to get in the know on this. Really? It takes a whole year to understand the jargon?
That was my experience anyway, yeah. I mean, and I should preface that by saying, you know, when we wrote this book, we tried to think of ourselves when we were young reporters here and, you know, just trying to learn how Washington works. And, you know, we could have used a guidebook or something like that sort of helped decipher a lot of what people were saying. Instead, you just kind of have to pick it up as you go along. And I think a lot of people just sort of feel the same way. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I think we were inspired to do this is that, and it's not just, as we say, this book is not just aimed at people in Washington. I mean, it's,
right.
You hear a lot of these same phrases at city councils and state legislatures. It's just like everything else in Washington, it's just more magnified here.
And do a lot of the phrases stay the same over the years, or do you find new phrases every year or every campaign election, big campaign election season?
It's interesting. Some of them do have long-lasting power. I think our favorite one, speaking for Chuck and myself in the book, or at least the one we got referred to most often when we were reporting and researching this book, was "My Good Friend."
Yes,
which is
right.
On the floor, on the House and Senate,
right.
Particularly on the House floor. And it's just so transparently false in that you know these people can't stand each other, and they probably don't even know who each other are in a lot of cases. But it's interesting. There were some of these terms that actually were generational. There's another one that's kind of a cousin of "My Good Friend." That's "I hold my opponent, quote, minimum high regard," unquote. And it's another sort of backhanded compliment, but not very thinly veiled. We heard this from an older generation of members. It was former Congressman Martin Frost of Texas who gave it to me. And we looked it up in the congressional record. It was used by, say, Lee Hamilton of Indiana or Wisconsin's own David Obie. That was one of his favorite phrases over the years many times. And then also each election cycle has its own new vocabulary. In 2014, one of the new terms is, quote-unquote, cantered, which means getting primary, means getting beat in your own primary, named after former House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, a Republican of Virginia.
And there's bound to be some other phrase coming up soon, being kicked out but landing a pretty lucrative job on Wall Street not very long after.
Yeah, well, we were just noticing the verdict in Virginia with Governor McDonnell, and I wonder if the next phrase is going to be McDonald.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We'll weave calls in and out because we have some good callers coming in now. John in Gays Mills, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you, John?
Real good. I always get a kick out of this. Was an after the election comment where the winner says and the voters have spoken. Uh-huh. And I've seen so many races where they win by 1 or 2 percentage points and they make it sound like the whole state backed them. And in reality, a couple 100,000 people didn't want you in there.
Right. Right. You're absolutely right. That is kind of a wishy-washy phrase, isn't it? And everybody uses it. It's just come up with something new. The voters have spoken. Really?
That, it's funny. That's one that can, is kind of double-edged. You hear winners say that, as the caller suggests, but sometimes you hear losers invoke it as well. It's like, well, we tried our hardest, we did the best we could, and put our plan forward, but the voters have spoken, and we abide by the result, or something along those lines.
Yeah. What about people who leave? How long has this been? And you would also think they ought to cut. Let's talk about things that they should come up with something new because they say it over and over again. It's really trite. When people leave politics or leave a position, I want to spend more time with my family. Oh, my gosh, if we've heard that once, we've heard it from so many people. They really do want to be with their family?
Well, we say in the book sometimes that people present that as a legitimately valid excuse. I think there was a CIA official, you know, who used that phrase and said, you know, really, it's true. Nothing is more important than spending time with my family. You know, but as we point out, often people that leave these senior positions, they're already in a position to spend a lot of time with their family because they can carve out a lot of time and things like that. And so it just, it's one of those ones that has become so cliched that it's kind of lost a lot of its truth for a lot of people.
Thank you very much, John, for your call. And if you'd like to join our conversation with your phrases, feel free to do so. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Here's a word that you say is used by many politicians, and it may be their most popular verbal clutch. The word frankly, is that to keep them, give them a pause so that they can think about what they want to say instead of saying, they say frankly?
Well, I think it's just one of those. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I was going to say, it is a verbal crutch in a lot of ways. It's a way to make it sound like they're being sincere. But when you say it sort of raises the question, if you're speaking frankly now, what are you saying the rest of the time?
Yes, right.
To invoke, again, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, he would say this so over and over again, along with literally, and it just raises questions about the sincerity of the rest of his comments.
Mm-hmm. What about President Obama? I'm trying to figure out what page I wrote. What is his most prominent verbal tic?
Oh, he says... one of the ones that he says a lot that we hadn't realized until we started doing the research is we need to have a conversation about.
Oh, he does
and
say
he'll
that.
Often, and yeah. He'll often say that when he gets into a situation that it's something that really has eclipsed his agenda, whether it's Edward Snowden's revelations of NSA spying or the legalization of marijuana in Colorado and Washington State, you know, something that he really doesn't want to deal with. And so it's kind of become his code for, you know, hey, everybody, just kind of calm down and let's go with my view of things.
Hmm. And let me be clear, is what you say is his most common verbal tic?
Yes.
Let me be clear.
That's kind of his wind-up for everything. And he's by far not the only person to say that. I mean, it's kind of the descendant of Richard Nixon's let me make one thing perfectly clear. You know, it's one of those phrases that's kind of mutated and changed, but has kind of remained the same as you go down political history.
Right. And I was just saying, of course, as president of the United States, Obama or any of his successors or predecessors had the loudest megaphone. So any of these phrases, maybe they don't even use it the most, but it just gets picked up on and the public and gets reported on the most.
Mikkel is our next caller in Madison. Hi, Mikkel.
Hello. I just had a comment and I guess a kind of question about how Obama's Yes, We Can statement was so influential during his campaign. And nowadays it seems to have been forgotten about and not used whatsoever. And I'm still kind of curious what that meant and what he's accomplished due to that statement.
Yeah, it's hard to think of using that as a phrase now. Yes, we can. We've lost all that. We lost a lot of hope, it would seem to me. That's a good question.
It is a good question. I think that actually well encapsulates a lot of the themes of the Obama campaign in 2008, where he made with the now president and candidate Obama used a lot of lofty rhetoric, but he actually didn't make that many specific promises. Yes, we can mean all kinds of things, and he ran on that, on hope, on other adverbs and adjectives. But he didn't really say a lot of what he was going to do in a lot of ways. So I think that's why some of his supporters are let down in many ways, because that spirit, which was sort of vague to begin with, has now evaporated.
The one, and you include this in the personalities in the first part of your book, the attack dog, the backbencher, et cetera. Let's start with the attack dog and the person. Oh, my goodness, you could write a book just of what she has said. Sarah Palin, the attack dog, who said phrases, and when I read them, I realize, oh, I would know who said that in an instant. How's that hopey, changey stuff working out for you? And she had many others, but she used them, I thought, very effectively. We may have gotten very tired of them, but they were fairly effective.
Right, and she was it was interesting the position she was in as only the second female candidate on a major party ticket. It may have certain resonance. Maybe this is probably a whole other discussion, but just coming from a woman candidate, it kind of comes off differently than a lot of men. That's not to say it's better or worse, but I think it's more memorable in a lot of ways. So that's why I think we remember she said also she was just such a character. Like her,
yes.
Dislike her, have whatever your feelings about her. She is an original, and
yes,
she was not your typical blow-dried male cookie-cutter politician.
So was it that we hadn't heard that kind of rhetoric before that made it stand out? Or I think you're right that it would be hard to imagine a male candidate saying that, but why was it that it was coming from a female that made it stand out?
That's a
good
question.
I think it just had to do with the fact that she really so gleefully relished that role. She was so delighted to be an attack dog that I think people really seized on that and said, hey, this woman really, really doesn't like Obama. And I think that kind of registered with people as, again, I think with her supporters as, you know, hey, this woman is real. This woman is genuine.
All vice presidential nominees, you write, and vice presidents play this role. Who does it very effectively? Does Biden?
I think Biden actually fits under that term in a certain way. Also to another one later in the book, Happy Warrior, where he can be very cutting and derisive toward his opponents, but he's always got that big grin on his face. He's Uncle Joe. He's much more likable. And you look back at somebody like, say, then-Senator Joe Lieberman in 2000 running with Al Gore, and he was maybe the exception of somebody who wasn't very good in the attack dog role. He tried it, but he never really seemed very comfortable with it. And, of course, in that debate with Dick Cheney, the Republican vice presidential nominee, a lot of Democrats were disappointed in that performance by Lieberman.
There are certain phrases, though, that I will always attach to certain politicians, and you can never get me past the Happy Warrior and Hubert Humphrey, who originally was
called that.
Yeah, because that's
We noticed he was the original Happy Warrior. I mean, he kind of embraced, which seems so anachronistic now, but you know, the politics of joy, he called it. He was sort of the last or the first of that breed.
We'll welcome more phone calls whenever you would like to join our conversation. Thanks, Mikkel, for your call. We're speaking this hour with the authors of Dog Whistles, Walk Backs, and Washington Handshakes. You've already heard what a third on that list was. What about Walk Backs and Dog Whistles and many other pieces of slang and jargon and bluster that are in the book, Dog Whistles, Walk Backs, and Washington Handshakes, Decoding the Jargon, Slang, and Bluster of American Political Speech. Our phone number is 800 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And we're also on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. There are various chapters here. The personality types are the first part of the book. Only in Politics Expressions, Chapter 2. Also in number 3, The End Game, People, Places, and Things, Both Real and Imagined, The Legislative Process, The Lingo of Campaigns and Elections, and Having to Explain Blowback on the TikTok, the Media, and Scandals. We certainly welcome your phone calls for our guests who are the authors of this book, Chuck McCutcheon and David Mark. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls for our guest. Mike in New Berlin is next. Hello, Mike.
Hello. I had heard a term used by some radio show hosts. Ned Schultz used it, and then it was low-information voters. Mm-hmm. And then I heard Rush Limbaugh stole it, and I thought he was using it very inappropriately. But anyway, thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's certainly one that Rush Limbaugh has popularized, even if he did not originate it. It came from the other side of the spectrum. We actually wrote about this one recently on our website for the book, dogwhistlebook.com, as part of bonus material. And, of course, low-information voters, it's sort of making an excuse when voters don't do something you want them to do. Rush Limbaugh said this repeatedly right after the 2012 elections when President Barack Obama was reelected, and it's really a not very marginally veiled insult to say, oh, people only voted that way because they didn't have enough information, when in reality there's no threat for information. People vote on all kinds of things, and his candidate still lost.
Thank you very much for the call. Is it true? It brings up an interesting point. We're in an era where everybody is so divided, and if you are liberal, you tend to watch or read certain things, conservative, different set of things. Do both of those camps have their own set of terminology, or do they freely use a shared political jargon?
That's a good question. In some ways, they've come to a meeting of the minds where they both might use the word, say, radical for the other side, and that used to apply, I'd say, more toward the left. You might think Berkeley protests, right, in the 1960s, et cetera. But of late, Democrats have talked about the radical right, the radical religious right, et cetera. So I'm sure there are terms that both sides have, but I think many of them actually are now used on both sides.
Yeah, another one that's in that extent that we use in the book is one that originated on Saturday Night Live with Will Ferrell, strategery. Remember, that was the word he used when he was impersonating George W. Bush. And now Rush Limbaugh uses that phrase, and so does Rachel Maddow, which we thought was really interesting.
Oh, and that strikes me as a word that just isn't a word, so you shouldn't use it.
Right. Well, I think it's kind of a winking phrase of a way of acknowledging, hey, I know this isn't really a word.
I know.
Anyway.
So. Right. I know what you're saying. What about this is one that kind of bugs me because it does show a lack of respect. And you write about the origins of this, which I didn't know about. When the Democratic Party is called the Democrat Party, even President Bush, you write in his State of the Union, I believe, it was in the script as the Democratic Party, but he was so used to saying the Democrat Party that he used that. Why is that? And it goes back to Joe McCarthy? Really?
Yeah, the funny thing about
Wisconsin's Joe McCarthy, yeah.
Huh. Yeah, go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, he used to use it in the 1950s, and I think it's persisted ever since. And I think because I think Republicans know that Democrats dislike it so much, and we quote an episode at a committee hearing involving Republican Jeb Hensarling of Texas using the phrase repeatedly, and finally Marcy Kaptur, a Democrat of Ohio, is just saying, you know, there isn't a single member on this side of the aisle that belongs to the Democrat Party. We belong to the Democratic Party. But then we also point out that Thailand actually has a Democrat Party.
So it's just something that will persist because it makes Democrats squirm?
Yeah,
I think, you know,
really?
I think anytime they object to it, I think people are going to, Republicans are going to say, oh, well, they don't like it, we'll keep using it.
Right, and it's not even clear the precise origins of it. Some people think that it's meant to say that the Big D Democrats aren't truly a Democratic party, or that they want, right, maybe want to get the word rats in there. It's not really clear where it comes from, but it doesn't really matter at this point. It only matters that it gets Democrats so upset and they get offended by it. And so Republicans, as Chuck says, just keep doing that to get them teed off.
Well, historically, it's not what it should be called. It would be as if the Democrats were calling the Republicans, I don't know what would be something similar. They would be offended by it because it's not what you call yourselves. So it's like giving somebody a nickname, and they don't want a nickname. They have a name.
Right.
So that bugs me.
Absolutely. What it's not doing, it's not extending that basic common courtesy where you'll hear rivals, Republicans who disagree with the president vociferously will still call him President Obama, mm-hmm, or Vice President Biden, et cetera. But in this case, it's not extending that basic courtesy to the other side.
Right. Chris is next in Mineral Point. Hello, Chris.
Hi. I really enjoy listening to conversations about language, especially. But when it comes to politics, one of the things that really bothers me is the misuse of the term slippery slope. It's often used as if that's a logical truth, when in fact slippery slope's a logical fallacy. And the other one that really bothers me are the existential threats. Because if it were an existential threat, would it not unmake reality as it exists? That's just what I see.
Thank you.
Those are both excellent points, and I would agree with you on both counts. I think existential threat is just one of those words that people bandy around because I think it sounds cool. We found a number of phrases in our book that are like that. And by the way, for people who love language or who love politics, we invite you to make contributions. We are really hoping that we can add to the list of terms in this book. And we encourage people to go to our website, dogwhistlebook.com, and offer any other suggestions of phrases that you think should be added.
All right, great. Thanks, Chris, very much for the call. David, what are dog whistles?
A dog whistle is a political message aimed directly at a specific group of people. Most famously, then-President George W. Bush was thought to speak encoded message to evangelical voters by using certain phrases from the titles of hymnals and biblical verses. And now Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, the likely Republican candidate for president in 2016, often quotes obscure Austrian economists as a way of getting at the libertarians. Most people never heard of these folks. And it's really meant to be like a dog whistle pitch, something that only the dog can hear, and it's inaudible to everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And walkbacks, the other part of the title, Chuck?
Well, walkback is, something when you said something you shouldn't have said,
right,
and you have to you have to apologize for it. You know, you have to walk it back. The phrase actually comes from walking back the cat, which is an old diplomatic expression. And as we point out, it's particularly common. It's common to a lot of high-profile politicians, but in particular, Harry Reid, the Democratic majority leader of the Senate, he's having to constantly walk back phrases every week. I saw he was just in the news just last week for another one. So that's, again, a term that's been around for a while that's kind of entered the common parlance.
Harry Reid finds his way into the book on several occasions, doesn't he?
Well, he does, partly because the Senate Majority Leader is so willing to make politically incorrect phrases, and in many ways he just doesn't really care who he offends. He even seems to delight in it in a lot of ways, and he's not running for higher office, and he doesn't really care what Republicans think about him, so he's willing to make a lot of these statements that go pretty far out, and often it's his staff members who have to try and quote-unquote walk back his embarrassing statements, although it almost seems like a futile exercise, and it's like, we've been through this before, we got to clean up for the boss again. And even when Harry Reid apologizes, he doesn't really sound all that sincere about it. Like he's too sorry to be saying to you. More like he's being forced to it, to go through the motion.
Remind us of exactly what he said about the president, the way that he spoke, and his being light-skinned. Some comments that I don't know why he ever said them, but he had to walk those back.
Right. This is, of course, was the president of his own party who he had urged to run for president and had supported. This was in the book Game Change, the blockbuster about the 2008 campaign. And I can't quote this verbatim without having it in front of me, but something about the then candidate Obama being a light-skinned Negro and I mean, I'm quoting Harry Reid here with those with those words, using some kind of dialect and just very politically incorrect statements. It's the kind of thing you might have heard of in the 1950s or 60s when Harry Reid was a young man and going getting into politics. And then his apology was essentially, "I'm sorry if I offended anybody," which is another ongoing theme in the book of whenever you use the word "if" in an apology, it means you're not really all that sorry about it.
Right. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you would like to join our conversation, we'd like to hear from you. We're speaking this hour with the author of Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes. As we have, I was surprised it didn't begin a lot earlier, but we are officially in the midterm campaign election season right now, so the book is quite timely. It's decoding the jargon and the slang and the bluster of American political speech. You may want to bring to the conversation something that you've heard that you wonder why everybody uses it all the time, or you wonder what it means, or you may want to bring up a historical reference as well. Our guests are Chuck McCutcheon and David Mark. Chuck, co-author of National Journal's Almanac of American Politics, co-editor of Congressional Quarterly's Politics in America 2010, and David, editor-in-chief of Politics and former senior editor at Politico, co-author of Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more phone calls. Mike in Eau Claire is next. Hello, Mike.
Yes, I was curious. I've heard a lot about presidential handshakes and how honorable it is to get a handshake from a president. But from president to other elite officials, I've heard that there are secret handshakes involved, and I was curious if this has anything to do with secret societies or things of that nature, you know, like Freemasons or bones, you know, things of that nature.
Chuck?
I sure don't know about that.
I'll definitely have to look into that. I mean, there were all these rumors, weren't there, about during the 2004 campaign that both John Kerry and George W. Bush were both members of Skull and Bones at Yale.
Yes,
so,
right.
Or at Harvard, maybe, was. So, yeah, I mean, at I don't know. I'll have to punt on that one.
Yeah, likewise. I didn't mean to kick it over to Chuck too directly. I don't have any inside information on it either. It's entirely possible. But basically, politicians are what I've observed, like most other people. They shake hands, and some of them don't particularly like it. In fact, I would just, if I can digress a little bit, they often have what's called body men, which is in the book,
yes,
where they, because they have to shake so many hands, they actually have the cleaning agent, et cetera, hand sanitizer right with them so they don't pick up germs, et cetera.
Yeah. I remember, you'll remember just historically, Bill Proxmire here in the state of Wisconsin, who would shake so many hands at State Fair every year. I mean, tens of thousands of people, and he'd have Band-Aids all over his hands because he had shaken so many hands. His hands were raw.
Yeah, that's indeed. And if you're going to shake hands, you've got to make people feel like you really mean it. So, indeed, I think the record for a handshaking is former Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Is actually in the Guinness Book of World Records for, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but it's thousands upon thousands of hands in a single day.
So he beats Bill Proxmire. Well, by golly. That floors me. I learned something today. Thank you, Mike. Thanks very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. What about that body man? You write about it gaining visibility during Bill Clinton's presidency. Have presidents always had a body man?
I think they've always had assistants with them, whether they were with them all during daytime hours. I'm not quite sure about that. I think it probably has to do more with the modern television presidency, where you're really in front of the camera and you want to look good at all times. I'm sure there were times, even going back to FDR's days when he was more in the White House, he had physical infirmities, where you didn't need that as much. But I think when you're on the road and out in public, you want to look as good as possible, and that's where these assistants come in.
KP has looked up Bill Richardson, and he writes, in 2002, Bill Richardson set his gubernatorial candidate set a Guinness World Record for most handshakes by a politician during an eight-hour period, shaking the hands of 13,392 people at the New Mexico State Fair and a tailgate party in Albuquerque. And, of course, he went on to win the race. Holy cow, can you imagine that many people?
Mm-hmm. Sounds
yeah,
miserable
I covered
to
Bill
me,
Richardson
but
for years in New Mexico. I can imagine that he was a great retail politician before he sort of his career collapsed in a lot of scandals.
Right. And was able to, I knew some people in New Mexico who were good friends of my mom's, actually, and they were staunch Republicans, but they loved Bill Richardson. He could work both sides of the aisle, it appears to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a real charmer. He, you know, he was in national politics for a long time, and he, of course, ran for president. That didn't really work out. And then, as Chuck said, he got surrounded with some scandals later on. But for a while, he was viewed as an up-and-comer.
Yes, he was.
The future of the Democratic Party. And, he clearly loved that aspect of the game. Not something I would particularly enjoy, but that's why I'm in a different line of work.
You know, maybe you should try it. You don't know. You might like it. Well, we've been talking a lot about how we're in this age of excessive partisanship. So I was interested that you included the term bridge builder. Are there any bridge builders now? What does it mean now? And is it really an archaic expression when you put it with our times?
Yeah, it's one of those terms that really lived on more when there were real conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. And it's somebody who is meant to, as the name suggests, be a bridge-building character, somebody who crosses the partisan aisle. Oftentimes it's more of a false construct. I would say George W. Bush on a campaign trail in 1999-2000 portrayed him that way, self as a uniter, not a divider, and he got into office and he governed in a different way. One elected official that I would mention in that regard is Wisconsin's own Congressman Tom Petri, who is retiring this
year.
And he's a pretty staunch conservative if you look at his voting record, but he's during his career, which is in Congress, which is now 35 years, he's really tried to work across the aisle, and I remember covering him. He seemed to actually like working with Democrats and forging those coalitions and at least trying to find some measures to compromise on, whereas for many of his colleagues on both sides, it's almost viewed as a punishment to work across the aisle. There's nothing good that comes out of it.
Yeah. Let's go to cable television and Sunday show chatterers. I'm so glad you included this because it did seem to me, before I ever read it in your book, that John McCain is on those shows all the time.
Right. Well, he's a regular guest, and as we say in the book, he's had, I think, more appearances on Meet the Press than anyone in the show's history. And, I mean, having covered him for many years, I mean, he's exactly what you want as a reporter. He's accessible. He always gets back to you. He's certainly quotable. And, you know, he's in a position of some authority and influence, in his case, on foreign policy. He's kind of emerged as Obama's main antagonist on foreign policy. And, you know, it's obviously irked a lot of Democrats that he's such a frequent presence. But, you know, he's really found a comfortable niche for himself. And I don't think I think his phone will continue to ring.
And before that, it was Bob Dole.
Right. Dole, I think up to that point, the time that McCain eclipsed him, was the record holder of appearing on Meet the Press and probably the other shows as well. And those shows are really geared, or at least traditionally have been geared, more toward Washington insiders, people who follow the political game on a daily basis. So in that kind of situation, where we started out talking about then Senator Dole talking about a subcommittee vote with that voter in New Hampshire on a Sunday show, that's actually quite appropriate, and people would know what you're talking about. So that was probably a better forum for him than a campaign trail.
Mm-hmm. You know what amazes me, and please tell me, because both of you are in the thick of it with all of these people in Washington who we're trying to figure out here in the sane Midwest, but the thing that I can never understand with all the people who think in this country, who think on issues, and there are so many of them, we always get the same people in front of the television sets, it's television monitors in Washington, D.C., when it comes to talking about policy. I've never understood that. Why is that, that everybody goes to the same sources all the time?
Well, I think, people develop a reputation like McCain does. And, I know that there are people who just aren't comfortable, believe it or not, politicians who are appearing on TV. Going back to a New Mexico politician who I covered, Jeff Bingaman, who was the former senator, hated really going on TV and really didn't he was personable enough, but he didn't really like talking to reporters at all. I remember his former press secretary told me how she used to have to try to bribe him and give him candy so that he would call reporters back in the afternoon and take their calls.
Oh, my gosh.
And I think there are other people like that who, you know, as we say, you know, in the book, the term workhorses and show horses, there are not to say that workhorses don't go on TV. They do. But I think show horses are more often more apt to show up on TV than workhorses. Mm.
Do you know what kind of candy it was?
Right.
That's great. Yeah, offer me candy. I'll show up for anything.
Right.
Well, and you include workhorses. Who, deservedly so, has a reputation in Congress for being a workhorse?
Well, Washingtonian Magazine does a poll every year, yeah, and they pick the biggest workhorse and the biggest show horse. And I think Chuck Schumer, senator from New York, he's been both. He was a show horse, and now I think he's considered a workhorse.
Right, and I'd say Senator Dianne Feinstein of California is also considered very much a workhorse. She's somebody who digs into legislation, reads the subcommittee reports, et cetera, even though she's on television a fair amount. And I mentioned him earlier, but Congressman Tom Petri is of Wisconsin is somebody who I think is viewed very much as a workhorse. And even David Obey, his predecessor,
yes,
who was chairman of the House, Democrat, of course, chairman of the House Appropriations Committee for some time.
Yeah, Paul Ryan
very much
has been on the workhorse
Paul
list,
Ryan.
Too, I think. Yeah.
You said Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan's been on the workhorse list, too, yeah, at least among Republicans.
Dick Durbin?
Certainly, yeah. Oh, yeah, I think he's also on that list, yep.
Yeah. And does it serve them well? Is it good to be on the workhorse list? Do their constituents know they're workhorses, or can they fool everybody by being a show horse?
It's funny. That's what they usually say when they're in trouble in a re-election bid. They say, well, I'm not on TV all the time. I'm just a workhorse
in
Congress digging into my congressional duties. So sometimes it can help them. I think it works probably better in smaller population states where they may even know the politician in South Dakota or Delaware or Montana or something like that. I think it's tougher when you represent a large state to just be a workhorse if you're representing California or New York or Florida or something like that. You have to be more of a media presence, if only to communicate with voters that way and get your message across back home.
Pete on an email writes, he wonders what happened to the term gravitas. When Bill Clinton was running in his second term, we heard daily that he had the gravitas to be president. For a while after candidates were measured to see if they had the gravitas to win, and then it faded away. Why is candidates' gravitas no longer mentioned? David?
That's a good question. That may be one of those terms that's just kind of a passing fad, even though the meaning of the term really is there. You hear it in other forms like graybeard, which it could sound like an insult, but it actually is meant to denote that somebody's been around for a while, they have some gray hairs, they're a wise man or woman or that sort of thing. And so I think these terms, sometimes the meanings are still there, but they just morph into different terms.
I would speculate that maybe gravitas somehow over time became associated with being boring.
Oh.
Because I remember when Senator Dick Lugar, who had as much gravitas as probably anybody who served in Congress
right.
in recent years,
yeah.
ran for president. I mean, he was tremendously respected for his gravitas, for his wisdom and knowledge. But, you know, he was considered boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think it kind of mutated into more of a pejorative term.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's interesting. Here's a term that's used so much, and it's it's interesting who used to use it, who uses it now, and that's the term elites. You write that it was commonly described as wealthy Republicans, country club elites, but it's very different now, isn't it? A pejorative description of Democratic intellectuals. Why was it popular at one time and then the Democrats took it after the Republicans had used it? I mean, it's interesting how both sides have used that term, and not in a positive way.
Yeah, I think it's a case of imitation being the sincerest form of flattery.
Right.
Like we saw that one side saw it work with their opposition, and they decided to adopt it for themselves consciously or not. I think Spiro Agnew, the first vice president under Richard Nixon, had something to do with that, where he had all kinds of memorable phrases going after the, say, coastal elites and the network news, et cetera. And it goes back even to the McCarthy days of going against Democrats that way. But it's interesting, that is one that continues to be used by both sides.
Mm-hmm. Blue Dog Democrats, is that phrase still used? Are there still Blue Dog Democrats?
Well, they're down to a handful. The Blue Dogs are a group of fiscally conservative Democrats. They tend to vote for Republican proposals for a constitutional balanced budget. They tend to offer their own budget proposals, which are more in line sometimes with Republicans than with Democrats. I mean, they used to be deal makers as recently as just 4 or 5 years ago when the Democrats had control of the House. I remember they were able to really make their presence felt on a lot of things, like climate change legislation, for example, that got through the House. But yeah, I think they tend to represent conservative districts, and over time they've either retired or they've lost re-election bids, and so their numbers are down to, I think, fewer than 20 in the House, whereas at one time they were over 50 or 60.
Hmm. What about progressives? What does that term mean now?
It's basically an alternative form of liberal, which many Democrats don't like to call themselves. Progressive, it has that connotation of being forward-looking. Liberal, somewhere along the way, got morphed into permissive, and it has a very negative connotation. So you hear even the most ardent Democrats not wanting usually to refer themselves to liberal. Well, that's changing a bit, but in Congress it's called the Progressive Caucus, and it's notable on their website they never once use the word liberal, although they're happy to use progressive repeatedly.
What about moderate Republicans?
There's not too many of those left. We also use the term quote-unquote reasonable Republicans, mm-hmm. which is sort of a pejorative that Democrats like to use against people. Like in our day, we knew reasonable Republicans who were willing to compromise, and it usually meant those who were willing to go along with Democratic ideas.
Well, gentlemen, it's been great fun. Please give us again the website that you're using so people can add to the list.
It's www.dogwhistlebook.com. And, we welcome suggestions from people, and we're really hoping we've been adding new phrases online each week, and we're really hoping that we can, have this book evolve and change with the times to adapt politically.
Yeah, and maybe some politicians will realize they're saying things that don't mean very much, and so they need to stop saying it, right? So it'll change after the next election.
Well, I'm actually of the view that I think voters would appreciate the candor and would actually open themselves up to it,
right,
and maybe
right.
vote for people who are just willing to say what they think and speak like a normal person.
Oh, by golly, wouldn't that be a great idea? I'm with you on that. Thank you for being with us. It was great fun. Thanks to Chuck McCutcheon and David Mark, and they are the co-authors of Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes, Decoding the Jargon, Slang, and Bluster of American Political Speech. And we do have that site on our Facebook page, too, in case you didn't get it and you want to add to their list. That would be great. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up. We'll be with you again next on Monday for all things political. Thanks for listening.